Hello and welcome to Great Lives. My guest this week is Jenny Agutter. Jenny will forever be associated with the film and television series The Railway Children. Many child stars fade, but Jenny went on to a formidable career on stage with the Royal Shakespeare Company and on screen. Her film credits include Equus, Walkabout, Logan's Run and the cult classic An American Werewolf in London. She played the treacherous Tessa Phillips in Spooks and, coming full circle, took the role of Mother in ITV's version of The Railway Children. So, Jenny, whom have you chosen as your great life? An actor, a spy, a founder of orphanages?
Well, actually, in a funny way, you've hit on a reason I've chosen the person I've done. It's a woman of science. Now, I have to say, I know nothing about science. I didn't study the sciences at school. I'm completely confounded by them. But I came across an extraordinary woman when I was actually looking up information about Edith Nesbit. And you made that link with Railway Children. Of course, Nesbit wrote The Railway Children. And at the turn of the century, there was an amazing young woman called Lisa Meitner. And she was a physicist. And the more I found out about her, it was one of the things like, you're sort of surfing and going through and finding out these people were at the same time. And whereas Nesbit was someone who very much was not interested in being a suffragette or in women's issues, Meitner, I suppose, again, wasn't interested in those issues, but was extraordinary in as much as she made her way through a very particular time where women weren't accepted into university, education was made difficult for them, and she surmounted these. I mean, we'll go through her life, and it is an extraordinary life.
It's very, very brave, and it's also very refreshing for us when people don't necessarily choose people from their own walk of life.
Yes.
A tennis star doesn't choose a tennis star, and a famous actor doesn't choose a famous actor. Now, you obviously don't know a huge amount about nuclear physics, and yet
Indeed.
You've chosen a physicist.
I'm completely puzzled by all the maths and the names and all the rest of it, but fascinated by the person. I suppose I feel, one of the other things that is extraordinary is I've been brought up in an age where I've taken for granted the fact that as a woman I can have equal opportunities, I can vote, I can all of those things. I've had an education, which I was, although it wasn't a particularly great education, it was cut short by my acting, I've still been allowed to do all of those things. And the person that I've chosen did not have those easy opportunities.
Joining us to flesh out the life of Lisa Meitner is Jeff Hughes, Senior Lecturer in the History of Science at Manchester University. Because of the appalling weather that we've been having, he's in a studio in Leeds. Jeff, we've all heard of Marie Curie. Why haven't we heard of Lisa Meitner?
Lisa Meitner has been written out of much of the history of 20th century physics, despite the fact that she made significant contributions to radioactivity and to nuclear physics. She was one of the co-discoverers of nuclear fission, which led to nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. After the war, her contributions were written out because of the politics of post-war Germany. We don't know as much about her as Marie Curie. She never won the Nobel Prize, for example.
To all of which I hope we'll come, but just starting from Lisa's original drive and motivation, where did her passion for physics come from? Did it run in the family? What do we know of her family background?
She was born in 1878 in Vienna. She was the third child of eight. Her parents were Jewish, and they brought her up in a very stimulating intellectual environment. Late 19th century Vienna, of course, was itself a ferment in art, music, architecture, philosophy, psychology. It's the Vienna of Freud.
I believe she was she actually started her interest in maths at the age of eight, though.
Yeah. She was formally schooled until the age of 14, and then she was privately educated.
Because she would not have been given the education any other way.
That's right, yeah. And her parents continued her education privately after the age of 14. She considered being a French teacher. But this was the time, the late 19th century, when the rules about the admission of women to higher education were all changing. And because she had private education after the end of her formal schooling, she was allowed to enter the University of Vienna in 1901 at the age of 23. And it was there that she gravitated towards physics. She signed up for lots and lots of courses, but she gravitated towards physics.
Physics obviously has a fascination. I think she had a particular professor there, but there is something about physics which deals with truth. Now, I wouldn't be able to deal with the science, but I do understand that through it, one's looking at absolutes. People are believing in all sorts of peculiar and random things. And I think her grandmother once said to her, if you sow on a Sunday, the heavens will come tumbling down on you. And she was a child, and she apparently decided to take out a needle and thread and do some sewing and a few stitches, and the heavens didn't come tumbling down. And she thought this was absolute proof that this, in fact, was just a complete, you know, ridiculous idea.
So she was an empiricist from the very start.
Absolutely.
Is there a point, Jeff, do you think, at which she became gripped with an ambition to push forward truth and knowledge in physics and in science, or do you think it came on her gradually?
I think it came on her gradually. She was inspired at Vienna University by the great theoretical physicist Ludwig Boltzmann, who himself was engaged in various philosophical battles about the meaning of science and the meaning of knowledge. And for Boltzmann, and later on for Meitner, physics was to be more of a calling than a career, and it was seen as a battle for ultimate truth. And when she goes to Berlin in 1907, Lisa quickly teams up with Otto Hahn to work in this exciting new field.
When you say working in this field, she wasn't allowed to work in any of the laboratories at that time.
Not at first, because when she arrived, women weren't admitted to the University of Berlin. So despite the fact that she was a researcher, she had to work in a workshop outside the usual university labs.
It's shocking, isn't it? 1907, that's not such a long time ago. Women weren't allowed to work in the university at all.
But it's also recognising there's a great mind there, but saying, no, you can't, because you're a woman.
So what was the job she did get, Jeff?
She was appointed assistant to Max Planck.
That's a name that's familiar to me, but no more than familiar. What is this man's status and reputation at the time that Lisa is attending his lectures?
He is the foremost theoretical physicist in Germany. He is the head of physics in Berlin. He has immense authority, and he has also immense intellectual depth and moral probity. And just as she'd admired Boltzmann in Vienna, Lisa comes to admire Planck in Berlin, and she remains friends with him for the whole of the rest of their careers. She becomes involved in his cultural circle. She attends his house, and they have music parties. She meets Einstein and various other people through the Planck circle.
Apparently, Einstein would play the violin.
That's right.
And Planck
the piano.
The piano.
Yeah.
Lisa Meitner was musical as well. It's a wonderful idea, isn't it? Chamber music at home.
But something is emerging in the character of this person whose life we're pursuing already, and it's really something you mentioned right at the beginning, Jenny, her passion for truth. And passion, I think, is the right word. It wasn't just a sort of academic pursuit of truth, but a passion for truth. And she's immensely impressed by Max Planck, who has this same sense of moral and philosophical purpose about his life. This is, if not unusual in a science, certainly distinguishes her.
Yes, and also what one reads about her is that she's quite a shy person, and she's living in a very masculine world and having to prove herself all the time. So she constantly must have been asking questions of herself all the time. So truth must have been just important to seek the truth and be true and honest to herself and not ever give up, you know, because it would just have been, I mean, the pressures not to do what she was doing would have been so great.
She was not then naturally an assertive person.
Not naturally assertive at all.
This is all true. If you read her correspondence, she's constantly questioning, she's constantly making great demands, in a way, of her friends. She expects great moral purpose of her friends as well as herself, and she's disappointed when they can't live up to those ideals. But at the same time, I think it's worth pointing out that her nephew once described her as short, dark, and bossy.
Is this Otto?
This is Otto Frisch.
Right. Short, dark, and bossy.
Short,
yes, I can imagine that. Yes, but that's what you... If you have to prove yourself, you might become short, dark, and bossy, you know.
Absolutely, yes.
If you have to offer the world an estimate of your character, I wouldn't ask your nephew if I was... I'm not sure what my nephews would say about me. Jeff, Otto Hahn, she begins to work with him, for him, collaborate with him. He's obviously becoming quite central in her life.
Yeah. Otto Hahn was a German chemist. He's 4 months younger than her. He's trained in chemistry, has specialised in radioactivity. He's worked with William Ramsay, a famous chemist in London. He's worked with Rutherford in Montreal. He's establishing his own lab and his own scientific identity in Berlin. She teams up with him. He's the chemist, she's the physicist. And they start working on this new field of radioactivity, a very complex field with lots of new elements being discovered and very complex issues of radioactive decay and lots of difficult and subtle science to be sorted out.
Can I just ask you a question here, just
yes,
at this point? It must have been an extraordinarily exciting time. And she's still a young woman. And also, the photographs I've seen her, an extremely attractive young woman. Mm. You read nothing at all about her involvement in her personal life. But one feels that there must have been some, even if it's just through the science, some extraordinary closeness between Hahn and Lisa Meitner. Does that come across in any of the writings?
That certainly comes across from their correspondence. They had a deep and enduring friendship that survived even the hardships of the Second World War and everything that happened during and after the war. But as far as we know, there's no personal physical relationship between them. Despite the fact that they were working together in the same lab 5 or 6 days a week in very close proximity, they never took lunch together. They never went for walks together, because those would be regarded at the time as signs of intimacy.
I understand.
And they wanted to be very careful not to give gossips the chance to
say those things. I can't
think
of anything more intimate than discussing really extraordinarily, you know, intricate ideas together with somebody and sharing
Absolutely.
Them. Can you imagine that?
Well, I can, yes. I must say, discussing radioactive decay...
That's what I'm saying. There can't be anything more extraordinary.
No, no.
That's right. And if you read their correspondence, you can see that she plumbs the depths of his psyche. She knows him extremely well. She knows him inside out.
Mm.
And yet it was a deep philosophical and moral friendship.
She's Jewish, Jeff, and she's a woman... being a woman isn't too cool if you want to pursue science at this time in the 20th century. And being Jewish is getting more and more difficult because this is the Germany between the two world wars. Does she manage to maintain an equal status with Otto Hahn, or how is she being seen at this point?
Professionally, the fact that she's a woman doesn't, in the 1920s, doesn't seem to matter that much. As far as the rest of the world is concerned, she's appearing on papers, scientific papers, with Hahn and under her own name, often as L. Meitner.
Mm.
Famously, when Rutherford visited Berlin and he met Meitner for the first time, he'd known Hahn for many years, he taught Hahn, but he met Meitner for the first time and he was taken aback and he said, oh, I thought you were a man, because he only knew her from her scientific work. So I don't think her gender mattered that much in this context. On the Jewishness, she in fact converted to Protestantism in 1908.
Yeah, quite early on.
Her family were in fact quite secular Jews as far as
yes,
I
they were.
They were not practicing, but he was a lawyer.
But that wouldn't do for the Third Reich, would it?
In retrospect, she very much said she should have left in 1933, as a lot of people did. But she just buried herself in more work. But it's at that point that she no longer is able to be recognised for her work, because more and more she's being pushed aside.
It's probably worth pointing out that after the Nazis come to power in 1933, Meitner's actually OK for a few years because she's an Austrian citizen.
Right.
So working in Berlin, she's OK, she's a national of a different country. It's after the Anschluss in 1938
that she's really put
in a difficult
position.
When
Austria and Germany become the same country.
Yeah.
Right.
In a letter that she wrote after the war, she describes what she did late, as you say, Jenny, in 1938. So as not to arouse suspicion, I spent the last day of my life in Germany in the Institute until 8 at night, correcting a paper to be published by a young associate. Then I had exactly 1.5 hours to pack a few necessary things into 2 small suitcases.
Yes.
That's extraordinary that she sort of hangs around for perhaps 5 years longer than she should, and then suddenly leaves in such a hurry. Is this because of...
But quite cool.
Yes.
I mean, go to the... stay there the whole evening, knowing you've got to do this. You've got two scientist friends, who are trying to get your route through Holland. She's obviously been told that she has to leave, you know, she should have left before, that it is getting more and more dangerous. Relatives of hers were sent to Dachau. And yes, and she writes that. It's extraordinarily touching. And then she doesn't make it across the border with those 2 suitcases. She ends up with a ring given to her by Otto Hahn and a small amount of money in her purse, and that's all she got across the border with.
Surely one of the most dramatic stories in the history of 20th century science. She stayed around after 1933 because she was so absorbed in the work and this was her calling. and that's what she wanted to do.
Describe her flight, Jeff.
She was in a state of legal limbo, in a way. She had no passport, she had no travel documents. She was unable to leave Berlin. And friends in Holland and in Scandinavia were trying to line up jobs for her to give her a reason to leave so that she could say to the German authorities that she had a post to go to. But it was, in fact, very difficult, partly because there had been so many other Jewish émigrés from Germany who were filling positions everywhere. It was hard to make a position for her. Finally, a Dutch friend, realizing that her case had gone up, in fact, to Himmler himself, the head of the SS, realised that the situation was now so urgent that something serious had to be done.
It's because another scientist that she's informed
of. It was Dirk Coster, who was a Dutch physicist who gets her out. And it was a scientist, a Nazi scientist in her own institute, who informed on her to the SS. So she, as you said, she packs a couple of bags. I'm not sure if it's cool or just terror, actually, that holds her there.
Mm.
It's impossible to imagine what must have been going through her mind that day.
Mm-hmm.
So she packs a couple of small bags. Hahn gives her the diamond ring as insurance, or perhaps to bribe the border guards. Her Dutch physicist friend has already spoken to sympathetic border guards to arrange that she should be given safe passage. And so she's smuggled out of Germany to Holland through a quiet border station.
What, Jeff, do you think the feelings of her colleague and friend Otto Hahn were as she leaves? Does he want her to stay? Is he pleased she's gone professionally? Is it good for him or bad?
I think Otto Hahn is torn. He's, at this point, the head of the institute where they'd been working. The institute has been gradually Nazified during the 1930s, and Hahn, in 1938, is effectively under orders to dismiss her. His main concern, I think, at this point, is to protect his institute. He realises that sacrifices have to be made for the larger good of his institute and to protect the work that's going on and so on.
Though he must perhaps miss her personally and certainly miss her professionally, it must be a huge weight off his shoulders not having to work any longer with a Jewish woman scientist in Germany.
It had certainly become very difficult for him. There were a number of committed Nazi party members in his institute who were making it very uncomfortable for Hahn. So, in the sense that it removed that problem, it was good for Hahn. At the same time, he needed Meitner to interpret a lot of the experiments that they were doing. By this time, they were working on a new series of experiments. And she was absolutely integral to the interpretation of these experiments, so they continued to correspond.
These are the experiments leading to
the discovery
of nuclear fission. These are the
experiments that led to the discovery of fission in 38, yeah.
Right.
It's the skills of chemistry versus the interpretations of physics.
But they do need one another.
And now comes the breakthrough, Jeff.
Yes.
And what's that?
Well, since 1934, numerous researchers in Rome, Paris and Berlin had been bombarding uranium and other elements with neutrons to try and create elements that were heavier than uranium, to try and create new elements, basically. And in 1938, Hahn and Strassmann realise that they cannot separate out, they cannot characterise adequately these supposedly heavier than uranium, these transuranic elements. And Hahn writes to Meitner and he says that this may seem incredible, but it seems that when we bombard uranium with neutrons, these subatomic particles, what we seem to get out of this experiment is barium, which is a much lighter element, not a heavier element than uranium. And Meitner gets this letter Christmas time in 1938. She's on vacation on the west coast of Sweden. Her nephew, also a physicist, Otto Frisch, is visiting her. And they read Hahn's letter. And between them, they figure out that what's happened is that the uranium nucleus has, in fact, split into two. And they coin the phrase nuclear fission to describe this process of the splitting of the uranium atom. But they also realise that in this process of splitting, a huge amount of energy is going to be released. And that, of course, opens a Pandora's box.
So let me get this straight. She, at 62, detached from the laboratory and a refugee in Sweden, provides the intellectual explanation, the theoretical explanation, for the work that Hahn and his colleagues are doing back in Germany.
That she'd been working on prior to
leaving.
That she'd been deeply involved in for several years.
And her within her explanation are the seeds of what led to the atomic bomb.
Yes.
And nuclear energy, which was her big thing, of course. But she saw the implications of the amount of energy that you could get from this. Presumably.
And she gets no credit for this?
No, because of the timing. If it wasn't for her sex, if it wasn't for her background, there could have been much more extraordinary things happening. And, of course, politics and everything is forcing the issue in a completely different direction.
And then the Nobel Prize for Chemistry...
At the end of the war.
...goes to Hahn and his colleague Strassmann, and Meitner is not mentioned. Do you think, Jeff, that Hahn felt by this point a sense of the huge injustice that unwittingly or unwillingly he had done to his old friend and colleague Lisa Meitner?
I don't think he did. He won the 1944 Chemistry Prize, which was awarded in 1945. Oh. It was to him alone. Strassmann didn't share in it either. Apparently he gave some of the prize money to Strassmann, who would not use it. But for Hahn, he quickly came to establish and then to internalise, to believe a myth that Meitner had nothing to do with the discovery of fission. He regarded it as the work of chemistry and chemistry alone. He regarded the actual experiments rather than the interpretation of them as the most significant thing. He saw it as perfectly proper that he alone should receive the chemistry prize. And in fact, he even told some people that had Meitner still been in Berlin, she might have talked them out of the discovery.
Well, indeed.
She might have made it seem implausible that they could have discovered such a thing.
Having said that, one also, you know, because the interest for me is this extraordinary person, I don't think she ever once mentions it. I don't think she harboured any resentment...
Oh, she must.
..at not being given the accolades.
This is the really interesting thing. She doesn't. She is actually enormously ambivalent about the Nobel Prize because of the fact that fission led to nuclear weapons.
Right.
She was absolutely stunned by the atomic bombing of Hiroshima.
I read somewhere that she was actually approached by the Manhattan Project, but
yes,
said no.
Was. When British scientists left to go to Los Alamos in 1943, they asked her to go along
right.
with them.
And she wouldn't.
And her refusal was instant and absolute.
Right.
She said she would have nothing to do with the bomb.
She is a very particular person with absolute views and desire for absolute truth.
Absolute moral probity, like Planck and Boltzmann.
Exactly.
Well, they tried hard enough. They tried hard enough to recruit her to that particular role. They wanted a human face, a human story for the atomic bomb, which we have to remember was enormously popular at the time. They wanted to cast her as the brave Jewess who fled Germany with Hitler's bomb secrets in her purse.
MGM made a film in 1946, which was called The Beginning of the End, which was about the story of the making of the bomb. And Meitner was shown the script, and she was even invited to be a consultant or maybe even to be in the film. And she considered the whole thing complete nonsense, just a rewriting of the history.
She refused
point blank to be involved. And she said, I would rather walk naked down Broadway than be involved in a film like that.
Quite right, yes.
Jenny, one thing Lisa Meitner did seem to be able to rely on was huge support, moral and material, from her family in pursuing her education. Did you get that?
I had enormous support from my parents, but I don't think they reckoned education as being a terribly important thing. And had I been there, I might have said, you know, don't worry about acting, do that later, get on with the education, get on with the university, because I've always felt a lack of it. And I think that's probably why, you know...
You didn't go to university?
I didn't. I left school at 17. When I did Railway Children, that was it. I didn't go back to school. So I had no education to speak of at all. Hence the no sciences, the no nothing. I've had to fill in the gaps as I've gone along and really feel the loss of any structured way of understanding.
I wonder whether that's one of the things that drew you to Lisa Meitner.
Yes, you know, obviously her parents were intellectuals. She had a big family, had huge support. But what they held as being, you know, most important was what education could give you. Again, this search for truth. I mean, the fact is we live through our understanding, and, you know, there is nothing better than being able to go through, I think, to a further education and better understandings of things.
Can I put it to you that we skew perspective if we look at Meitner's life just through the prisms either of her gender or her Jewishness? Other Jews did gain recognition. Other women did too. Look at Marie Curie, whose fame arguably elbowed her husband's achievements aside. Seems to me that you have to add to Lisa Meitner's bad luck in being a woman when it was hard for women to make headway and being a Jew at a critical point in the Third Reich two other important bits of bad luck. Fate confined her at an important period to doing the thinking while others did the experimental work, and it's often the experimental work rather than the rationalisation behind it that gets the credit. And then when fate offered her a fantastic catch-up opportunity, the chance to associate herself personally with the atom bomb, she turned it down on grounds of conscience because she couldn't approve. Yeah. So she was a woman, she was a Jew, she was a theoretician, and she was a conscientious objector, and she was just four times unlucky.
Yes. And I suppose at the very beginning, her very choice of subject, the game was going to be the one thing that she couldn't really play with in the end. She was thrown into a world that she couldn't come out of with kind of glowing colours and with all the awards. And maybe that's why she was very happy not to. But she did actually dedicate herself, you know, she carries on as most extraordinary scientist. As I say, she inspired so many people in her life. I think that is extraordinarily admirable. It's what you leave behind. Not necessarily just one achievement, but that you leave people creating more and more. I think it was an amazing life.
She was a victim of the sort of willed historical amnesia of the German scientists in a certain way. Her name was written out of that story for many people. But she is now remembered. She's embodied in the periodic table of the elements. In 1982, physicists in Germany synthesized a new element heavier than uranium, and it's now officially named Meitnerium in honour of Lisa Meitner.
The heaviest element.
The heaviest element, yes.
She came to England at the end of her life and spent the last 8 years in Cambridge.
Yeah.
And then when she died, she was buried at Bramley in Hampshire, which she loved. And there's a rather wonderful quote on her gravestone. It just simply says, Lisa Meitner, a physicist who never lost her humanity.
My thanks to Jeff Hughes, our scientific expert, and to Jenny Agutter for her choice of great life, the Austrian physicist Lisa Meitner. Goodbye.